Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, welcome to episode 10 of Playboys. Myself, Dean, as always, joined again by Alex and the returning PJ. Hello, guys.
Hello there.
Oi.
We got three of us. And guys, which play are we doing today?
What are we doing? Drum rolling.
Taming of the Shrew. There was some sort of setup there that I was supposed to follow, or...
Just drums rolling in your head, guys. So it's the Taming of the Shrew, guys. We have been fearing this play, to be honest, but it must be done as it's in your GAC.
The A-level curriculum, yeah. I'm gonna make the joke. So I hear you're a sexist now, PJ.
Ah, the far Ted joke there, right there.
No, guys, look, we're gonna just give the disclaimer before we start, and we're gonna try to be brief with this one, because none of us were like massively looking forward to covering it.
I'm actually quite fond of the play.
Would we call this a problem play? Would we think that's fair? Yeah.
A problem play in many senses.
Problem play doesn't really mean like it has problematic elements. It's more that it's a problem to classify.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Or at least this is just problematic elements then. This is maybe slightly different, but this one, this is a tough going for the modern reader at times.
It is indeed, yeah. I mean, like, I was a bit surprised that they're showing this at school because it must be the most outdated play ever from Shakespeare.
It is. I mean, it's also got some of the worst reviews that I've seen just, online of people, reviewing the plays and things. Alex, from the perspective of someone who's actually watched the, not just read them, but, like, watched them all and looked at those kinds of reviews, is it still getting the worst?
So I watched a very specific one, and... So what they did was they gender bent it. And so the women were played by men and the men were played by women. And it really made the problems with this play stick out. Like you can kind of go into it in today's mindset and see like a man treating a woman this way and be like, yeah, that's comedy. But when you see it the opposite of a woman treating a man this way, you're like, there is a problem with this. Let's figure out why. And then reading it again this time, I'm like, yeah, this is really bad.
The whole play's a problem. I mean, I read this years ago, and I think at that time, maybe we're just being a little bit younger or whatever, and I'm being around the age of the people who are studying this. I obviously I knew it was bad, but I thought it was almost so ridiculous as to be funny. So I wasn't laughing at the jokes. I was laughing at the ridiculousness of the play. But this time I couldn't even do that. I was just like, no, this is too much.
I feel like they are trying to, or Shakespeare was trying to do something more satirical here. And I can see that a bit because there's no reason for Kate to be this way, to be so, I don't know, hateful at times. But also when she's treated the way she's treated, I completely understand.
Yeah. So look, let's give the 10-second summary of this play. Essentially, man wants to marry, to marry girl, crushes her into submission, and the happy ending is that it works. The happy ending is not that she resists.
Well, look, I'm gonna give it a controversial opinion. I actually like the play, to be honest. And look, there are two ways to look at this play. Either it's a very sexist, outdated play, or either as you were saying, Alex, it's a satire on play. Mm. You see, this is Elizabethan time. This is the 1590s, and that was that's a turning point in English history, and you can see it in the plays written at that time, not just with Shakespeare, also Marlowe. And I don't believe that Shakespeare could have written Rome and Juliet a year later, approximately. of course, no one is sure how much when he wrote these plays. But I don't think this is his opinion. This is literally the characters are vile at the end, completely vile at the end.
It's kind of too like, much of a parody. He's trying to do like what he did with John Falstaff a little bit in like Merry Wives of Windsor, which is also quite disliked by a lot of Shakespeare fans. But I will say this play is fantastically written in that it's very easy for me to get through. It is, it has some really good quick wit in it. Like there are certainly parts that I like, whereas like the story last time when we were doing, oh man, what was that?
Winter's Tale.
Winter's Tale. Yeah. That is just a mess. This one knows what story it wants to tell, and it creates very smart, interesting characters. However, there's always going to be that part of me like, yeah, this is completely immoral and against all ethics I have. I can't get into it as much.
I think I would agree entirely.
More satirical, hey, it might actually be better. Someone I talked to said that this is their favorite comedy.
Well, I thought that a long time ago. But look, let's quickly mention the dramatis persona, right? So who is actually in this play? So in terms of the main character, I suppose let's start with the shrew herself, right? Katharina. And she has her sister Bianca. So we've got two sisters and their father and Baptista. And, you know, some suitors will come to Baptista and ask to marry the two sisters, effectively.
The youngest one, actually.
Effectively the youngest Bianca one, to begin with. Yes. Until Petruchio, a gentleman of Verona, then obviously he wants to go with Katharina. But all the previous suitors have been interested, you know, Gremio and Hortensio and so forth, they've all been interested in the beautiful and less shrewish Bianca, right? She's supposed to be the prize. And beyond that small kind of main cast of characters, we've got like a few servants and people like that, Tranio and Biondello and just a few, you know, minor characters. But really the core cast of characters is pretty small.
You forgot Lucentio.
Lucentio. So that's Lucentio and his dad, Vincentio.
So it's very important to mention that Bianca has three suitors who basically want to be with her. And Lucentio is the one who arrives to town. But so they try to find someone who will actually court the elder one, because the idea is that the father doesn't want to give away the youngest daughter because the oldest daughter has to be married first.
And then let's talk about the most important characters of all. Christopher Sly, the tinker, and the various assortments.
I love that intro. Like, I forget, they call it induction in this?
Induction,
yeah.
Yeah, that is really fun. Like, hey, this guy's drunk. We're going to treat him like he's royalty and just have a laugh. Like,
There's a lot of talk.
Go ahead, BJ.
There's a lot of talk about the induction because Shakespeare didn't really do induction so much. He did plays within plays, as in Hamlet. But the induction here is something that was used by other playwrights. The idea is that perhaps Shakespeare was distancing himself from the play, from the morality of the play, by doing an induction. And that's a theory that's widespread and kind of might make sense.
Yeah, that works.
If it came back more often and it was like a Sly wanted more
we know that Shakespeare doesn't know how to write a chorus, right? And that problem stands to the induction.
And the problem is as well, interesting that you mentioned that, Alex, because the problem is that all Shakespeare plays would have been seen back then. So Christopher Sly is a very central character. He's always there in the background, but you forget that when reading, so it's not really a play to
read. He's there, but he might as well not be for the second half of the play.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I would be surprised if a production of this had him on stage watching the whole time. I feel like that's not even happening, to be honest.
Yeah,
I mean, in theory, he's watching, you know, but I feel like
he shows up one extra time in the play. But if you had him
briefly
throughout, that could actually be pretty fun.
Yeah, I mean, he shows up basically at the end of the first scene for like two or three lines, and then that's it. And this is how Shakespeare treats his chorus generally. And this induction is essentially similar to how he uses a chorus, and he doesn't know how to use a chorus, and the induction is pointless. you know, but again, as you say, maybe the point of it is this idea about setting it with, you know, one step away from reality. And that's fine if, as you say, it had come back maybe between every act or something like that. But it doesn't. It just disappears.
Like, yeah, you are correct saying that it's pointless. However, it is the best Shakespeare's ever done with it, I feel.
Yeah. It is fun. It is enjoyable. You know, it is enjoyable. It's sad that it doesn't come back. You know, it's better than his other attempts.
And, you know, Shakespeare does like to make a point that is a play. So it does the whole play within the play, you know, very, very importantly in Hamlet, right, where Hamlet sees his own father being murdered in a puppet play. So he likes, Shakespeare likes to play around with his notion of what's real, breaking the fourth wall. So in
sure,
a sense, that's
Midsummer
quite,
does the same
quite,
thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So shall we give the quick kind of 30-second what actually happens?
The summary is that it's very simple, guys. The three lads, the three suitors, want to be with Bianca, so they find a way to... They basically search for someone to marry Katharina first. And they find this man who's quite... he's a horrible man, in fact. And basically... I'm forgetting the name now, guys. Petruchio. And Petruchio basically, he convinces the dad that he will marry Katharina, and he does all he can. He's very shrewish himself. And although Katharina is against this idea of marrying him, he just ignores her completely and then carries her off, literally, figuratively, out of stage into their home. And in the meantime, the suitors, they try to get together with Bianca. And that's basically the story.
There's some good quick wit there, but then Petruchio, he's just after money. We know that he lives in a place that's pretty run down. He has servants, but it's not great. Mm-hmm. And so he just wants money, forces her to marry him against her will. She absolutely hates him. And yeah, he spends most of the play breaking her in a way. But yeah, for the induction, I guess, Dean, you might be able to do it better, but there's a drunk guy who passes out and a lord and some servants show up and see him. And they basically say, let's play a prank on him and clean him up, dress him like royalty, treat him like that.
He's a lord, yeah.
Yeah, treat him like a lord.
But look, the induction, yeah. I mean, basically that happens. They sit down and they say, we put on a play for you. Here's the play. And the play is The Taming of the Shrew. So the induction is separate, essentially. That doesn't really come back again. So other than a few lines. So let's talk about the actual play. We start then. We open Act 1, Scene 1. We're in a public place, and we've got Lucentio. So, I mean, Act 1, Scene 1, I suppose really what it's doing is it's setting the scene for what we're going to see in the play. So we've got Lucentio, we've got Tranio, and then we move over and we've got the two girls, we've got, you know, Bianca and Katharina and their father, Baptista, as well. So I suppose that the key thing that I take from this act is they're talking, and at one point Hortensio and Gremio are essentially talking about, we need to get a suitor for Katharina. Because there's this idea, essentially, that Baptista wants Katharina to be married before he will let Bianca get married. And that's the ongoing theme throughout the play. The older daughter should be married first by some arbitrary rule that he's decided on. And so we get them saying, you know, things like they compared her to rotten apples, and they say, you know, she's a husband, a devil. A devil. And they say, you know, it would have to be a devil to take this shrew, essentially. Like no normal happy man is going to come in and marry Katharina. That's effectively the rhetoric of this scene.
Exactly. And yeah, so the next scene goes in. So they do find someone, as we mentioned earlier, who kind of, he's just looking for money. So as long as he knows he's getting the money, he doesn't mind what kind of woman it is. And there's a lot of comparison again to him and to the woman and all the battles he's been through, all the difficulties of life, you know, of natural forces that went against him, and no woman would ever stop that. So he really takes the challenge on, and he is, I think there is a lot to the, I think there's a lot to the character in the sense that he is quite out of his mind, isn't he? He's quite out of his mind because he just, as we know is on later, he also says a lot of things that don't make sense. So I think there's a lot of reason for him actually being insane. So he does this.
I think he's doing it on purpose.
To what do you think he's doing on purpose? As to control her.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. He's doing exact opposite. Like, yeah. You see the moon? No, it's the sun. No, it's the moon. And
yeah, no, it's the 1984 trick. You know, you hold up three fingers and you tell me it's two, and I'll basically torture you until you tell me it's two. You know, that's what he's doing.
Interesting analogy. That's
weird putting
And it's quite sad, right? Because she basically becomes, she becomes submissive at some point because she quite literally gets, starved, and she doesn't get proper clothes, and she gets insulted, and it becomes very difficult to read. I really enjoyed the beginning of the play, to be honest. I think it's quite witty, but there comes that act four, where they're already married now, and it does become a bit difficult to read at that point. That's the hardest part for me.
I would say for me, it's right before they get married, when it's like, I don't love this guy. And then Petruchio says, oh, she's just saying that because we're in public.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's a tricky scene, but we'll get to that in a second anyway. I mean, anyway, there anything else to cover, like anything important to cover in Act 1? I mean, I suppose Act 1 is two scenes. Scene 1 just kind of introduces that main theme.
There is something very important to mention, something that's very big in Twelfth Night and A Midsummer Night's Dream. So a confusion of identities and deliberate confusion of identities. So for some reason, I don't find it's too clear, Lucentio decides to not show himself to Bianca and her father, and he makes his manservant, Etranio, dress up as himself while he pretends to be Cambio, the literature teacher, which literally means change in Latin and Spanish. So that's an interesting name to use there.
That's an appropriate name,
He should have essentially guessed, Baptista, that something was wrong. We call it Cambio.
I just love that once they dress up, even people that you've seen before in these plays, they're just like, well, I have no idea who this is. He's put on a hat and a mustache. So, you know.
But, and that's a big Shakespeare thing, you know, like he plays around with this confusion and people changing identities. And Twelfth Night is the absolute perfect play for that because they switch genders as well. I love that play. But here it's done a bit as well. And this is an earlier play.
I think it's more about changing class, right? The servant's going to look more like a servant, whereas Vicentio is going to look more like a lord. So that seems to be the main thing, not really disguising face or anything like that.
And interesting relevant class is, right? Because class seems to literally make everyone blind. I mean, okay, so you know, it just, that can't be him because he's dressed like a lord. So it just can't be that manservant I might have seen yesterday. It just can't be. So it is a farce, but it does play with reality, truths.
Yeah, the only part of Lucentio's plan here that I understand is that he wants to get close to Bianca, and that's why he becomes the tutor. Mm-hmm. However, this plan has so many holes.
Oh, this is a ridiculous plan.
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
Like, it's I'm going to make sure my servant tries to get her father to marry me, but my servant's going to act like me and then profit? I don't know.
Yeah, ? Step 5, profit. It doesn't really.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there's a bit of it isn't in the end the best plotted play from Shakespeare, but it does lead to some very comical moments. I did laugh out loud two or three times in this play, which I don't
know. There are some funny moments, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even at the beginning of Act 1, Scene 2, we get little jokes between Petruchio and Gremio where they talk about knocking on the gate and it's like, knock me soundly and, you know, I'll knock you here, and he's going to knock him, you know, on the head, essentially. And it's a lot of that kind of going around, just kind of wordplay. So little bits like that to remind you that this is a comedy and to get a little chuckle from time to time.
They do that a bit. Even later on in the play, it's like, take my wife's gown, and it's like, you want me to do what with her gown? Not this is your wife. That gown.
In fact, that's one of the strong points of the play. I find the playing around with language and that confusion, and I find it's a great play for that. It's the comedy of errors, but the comedy of errors perfected that, I would say. But And the Comedy of Errors probably was written around the same time, if not in the same year. But nevertheless, it tried to do that, I find, was the language.
Yeah.
You mean, well, the brother Menachmi perfected it. Sorry, <yes. laughs> I'm never going to get over that.
Shall we move to Act Two then? What do we think about Act Two? So I guess we open Scene One with Bianca and Caterina, and then Baptista is there as well. But we essentially have a conversation with the two sisters, and we get to see what Caterina's really like, because she strikes Bianca. Like, you know, it's 20 lines in, she strikes her. That's her character, right? That's, you know, they paint the tone. We're not supposed to like Caterina. She's rough. She's aggressive from the beginning.
Problematic scene, I suppose, because, you know, because the feminist is trying to defend this place somehow by making Caterina like an individual woman. Yet nevertheless, she has also this touch of insanity, really, to be striking her sister. But I suppose you could also see it like an act of absolute frustration. Absolute frustration about her whole sex being so tame, and she's trying to really strike out literally to all the women.
Yeah.
It's like, so that's another way.
Have a personality, be somebody. Don't just be what these men tell you to be.
Exactly. And then we see her, I mean, Act Two only has one very long scene of 400 lines. And as it goes on and on, you know, then Petruccio is introduced. Caterina tries to strike him at one point as well. So, you know, yeah, she's this shrewish character. And as you say, like, maybe it's because of how she's been treated or whatever. But what do we think of the initial interaction between Caterina and Petruccio in Act Two?
Honestly, fantastic.
Yeah.
That's one of the scenes that I have to take a look at, because, like, so Petruccio says, "Alas, good Kate, I will not burden thee, for knowing thee to be but young and light." She says, "Too light for such a swain as you to catch, and yet as heavy as my weight should buzz. Well, ta'en, and like a buzzard. O slow-winged turtle, shall a buzzard take thee?" And just the good back and forth there, like, that's my favorite scene in the entire play.
And as you mentioned, it is also disturbing then, because later on it's a bit disturbing in the sense of that he doesn't want to. Well, I'm skipping ahead. Sorry, guys. Well, I just skipped ahead now. So the next scene is basically that the father is asking, "Sorry, you guys, going to marry?" And he pretends nothing of that ever happens. But you're going to just shows you how strong men were also in class, right? So if this is a play about society, that doesn't matter what the woman said, even if it's your own daughter. This man said this, so the daughter is obviously raving mad. I mean, it's also just the whole play could be seen as a very strong feminist play in the sense of, well, women have no voice here at all. And it's been done also in it's been also done to some extent in Greek plays as well. I mean, the theme is always there, so I find that very strong. And as you say, Alex, very disturbing, because this could be the plot of a very disturbing psychological thriller or horror film, where the woman just, like, you know, everyone thinks I'm crazy, that the man says this and that, and the theme has been used for films.
Yeah,
and that's why I think the Royal Shakespeare Company switched the men and women parts.
Yes.
Because they wanted to point out, like, all right, this is not okay, and it's using it for that purpose.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way of doing it, actually. I think that's a very tactical move. Normally, I don't like changing the plays, but with this one, I think that someone needs to say something about it. And I think that that's maybe a very good way to do it.
We'll have to talk about Beckett later, but...
Actually, no, I love it, because they did the same for 12th Night, which was mentioned. They switched the genders around again, so it makes it very confusing, because they're very changed around in the Shakespeare play. I love that Shakespeare plays are so organic, so you can do a lot with almost all of them. You can really mess around a lot.
So, guys, the only other thing I want to take from Act Two is, I mean, you already touched on it there, actually, but the bit where essentially Baptista is being told by Petruccio, like, yeah, it's grand, we're going to get married, I've just spoken to Caterina, it's all fine. She doesn't make that many protests. I mean, she says, "I would sooner see you hanged, right, than marry." But no one kind of pays any attention to that. And then, you know, Petruccio just says, "Yeah, no, don't worry, we're grand." And that's it. She doesn't say, "Oh, by the way, Dad, no, this is nonsense. I don't want to marry him." Like, at no point does she then... That's it. She just goes along with it somehow.
I think she says a little bit, like, at the time of the wedding.
A little bit later, maybe, like, at the wedding, yeah. I have this problem a lot. They don't resist enough in these plays.
No, I think, personally, I think she does. she does all she can, but there's a limit to how much she can do. And eventually she kind of gives in to the whole language tyranny her husband makes her do. Mm. I think she does, but it's maybe not enough, but because she realizes also that she's not being heard. Maybe she's a lot smarter than we initially think she is. And she actually realizes she's not crazy. She just realizes that no one listens to her. So she actually stops after a few strikes, a few protests. Won't make any difference.
Although we haven't touched on it, but yeah, my favorite thing that she does do, like just to get at these people, is she basically takes a lute and bashes it over a guy's head.
Exactly. Yeah.
That is probably my favorite gag in the entire thing.
Yes, there's
not
a bit
necessarily
where they
relevant
say,
to what we were talking about, but
there's some wordplay though where they mention, you know, have you broken her to the lute yet or something? And he says, yeah, she's broken the lute on me or something. Like there's a little bit of wordplay there, you know.
So it is.
Yeah, and when doing the play, you actually see the actor come out with a lute around their neck.
Like,
oh, it is a great visual gag.
Well, again, really relevant, just saying to everyone there that even though I love reading Shakespeare, it wasn't meant to be read. So really, you should see, watch Shakespeare even be there. That's what it was written for. That's what that might lead to some confusion as well during the writing, or even the humor might be lost. It's a very visual thing.
Mm.
Very, yeah.
So let's move to Act Three, guys. Act Three, I mean, these are all quite short acts. Act Three has two scenes. The first one's not even 100 lines. You know, the second scene ends a little bit longer, but 250 lines, I think. The plays, we're flying through the play, you know, and that's the thing about this play is it flows very, very quickly, actually, I think. Mm.
Yes, I mean, it's, I agree. I still think, I just mentioned it, for example, that The Comedy of Errors is even faster paced, even more of a joy, but The Taming of the Shrew, I find there are a lot of similarities. The Taming of the Shrew is just a slightly less perfect play, but it is. It's very easy to read. It's very readable. I just find Act Three, it's what do you think of Act Three?
Well, scene one is just a music lesson, but scene two is where the action really happens then in Act Three.
Exactly.
And I suppose this is where we get to the wedding, essentially. This is where Caterina marries Petruchio. And afterward, you know, again, you say she resists and she says a few things, but I, you know, if it comes down to, you know, saying your I do's, you know, she goes along with it at the end of the day. And they're married.
That's true. Yeah. And
it was expected for her by her father. And she was in a tough spot. There wasn't much that she really could have said. Even if she said no, what would have happened then?
Well, yeah, that's the question. Maybe not a lot. Maybe she would have married off anyway, you know. But there's an interesting part here where now we see Petruchio's plan really towards the end of this act, because they want to, I guess, celebrate, have a bit of a honeymoon or a bit of a post-wedding feast or whatever it is, reception, you know, that kind of stuff. And Petruchio's kind of like, yeah, well, we're going. We're not even kind of going to stay for dinner. That's it. And they entreat him to stay. And he says, you know, I'm content that you entreat me to stay, but I'm not going to stay. I'm just content to be entreated.
I entreat you. Exactly. And then we move on to the courting of Bianca and her three suitors. And she's just a big contrast to Caterina. She even says at one point, I must believe my master, else I promise you I should be arguing still upon that doubt. She's a contrast, and her name, again, it's very important, the naming of
It means white. Plays.
Exactly, white.
Yeah.
But is that, so I mean, and superficially, she's this innocent little kind of, I shouldn't even say it. I don't want to say it badly, actually, but I suppose this innocent, naive girl. But is that always a good thing? And I feel like superficially, yes, she's the beautiful one, and in the feministic level, she's striked because she has no character. She must believe her master. She gets seduced very easily, I find. Did you get that impression as well? I'm not sure if that's just me reading it.
He gets seduced easily enough, but he does try to, you know, to bend her to his will. And at the beginning of Act Four, we get some of it in summary form with just the servants,
we're talking
Romeo
about
and Curtis.
Bianca.
Oh, you're talking about Bianca.
About Bianca.
Yeah. And there is, so you skipped over it in Act Three, Scene One. You were talking about the music lesson. I think that's when it was. Because this was also the time that Lucentio was teaching her Latin. And while he was teaching her Latin, he was saying, I'm Lucentio. This is what I am. And she says, yes. I don't know you, I don't trust you. Like
between the Latin, I thought it was clever.
Yeah,
like
saying
between the Latin. Oh, yes, they speak between the Latin. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So I don't know you. I don't trust you, but keep trying. Something like that.
I suppose so. She's not quite. Yeah. So that shows some. That's
But we want to try and hurry this along, so let's spend a few minutes in Act 4 and a few minutes in Act 5. So Act 4, essentially, we have the servants talking about a lot of stuff that we don't see, essentially happened off camera. The journey there, I guess, was a bit arduous. Petruchio was kind of mistreating Katerina, like, along the journey. Grumio describes the whole ordeal of this journey, like the horse falling over and all this kind of stuff. And it all sounds a bit, you know, dirty and messy and unpleasant of a journey to get to, and that's essentially the beginning of like taming her, right? Just making her leave immediately after the wedding, going through an arduous journey of actually getting home, and then once they are home, he then starts into how am I really going to mistreat her, which is, as you said earlier, BJ, she's not allowed proper meals, she doesn't get proper, you know, bedding, and we get the famous phrase kill her with kindness, which people constantly use wrongly. Which is not to be kind, but to actually be quite horrible and just say that you're being kind. It's essentially gaslighting. Mm. And he's constantly saying, you know, oh, this food isn't good enough for you. It's overcooked or it's whatever. And this bed, this, you know, this pillow is lumpy. You can't have that. And just take them off her then. And then she's
not too big. The dress is terrible. Yeah.
And I want to point this out when people say, you know, I'll just kill him with kindness. But what they mean is be kind. I'm like, yeah, that's not what that means. That means the opposite.
Yes. Exactly, and essentially that's what Act 4 is, right? That's it's basically it's kind of a torturous scene, while at the same time the subplot is developing, and Lucentio is about to marry Bianca, but he has to convince a merchant to be his dad. So again, there's a lot of identity role playing going on. So the merchant pretends to be Lucentio's dad, but Lucentio is being played by his servant. Don't forget.
Yeah, Tranio, isn't it? Right. Tranio. Is this stuff important to you? You know, for me, I really cared about the story with Katerina, and then when I would be reading these bits, I was like, this feels this is nonsense. You know, we don't really
Bianca Lucentio stuff isn't necessary, is it?
It's enjoyable. Sorry, but you're right; it's not necessary.
Perhaps I thought it was actually more amusing than the main plot.
Oh, really?
But yes. Yeah, I thought so, because it just reminded me of Twelfth Night. I preferred that part of Shakespeare. I thought it was too straightforward. I enjoyed the old gender swapping, identity swapping, class swapping. That for me is in the end more intellectually stimulating, I suppose.
It's more classic comedy, you know, anyway. It's more classic Shakespeare comedy, really.
Exactly. Essentially, it's kind of almost like a comic relief, isn't it? Because it's so dark, to be honest. The real story is so dark. I mean, really, it's a tragedy, isn't it? Telling you the truth. That this is a kind of a constant comic relief to make sure that that women don't start to be hysterical because they're probably identifying themselves as Katerina. That's what I've...
We'll have to put them into some sort of home. Yeah.
It should be a tragedy, but, you know, the things that happen in it, but sadly it is a comedy. But we finish off Act 4, I guess, if we kind of skip to Scene 5, with the bit you mentioned earlier where, he convinces her that it's the moon and not the sun or the other way around. And he basically... She just has to agree with what he's saying, essentially. And this is him... having tamed her, you know, with just by mistreating her, essentially.
Well, she still fights back a bit. Like, yeah, whatever you say.
It's she's not a bit snarky to, with him.
Like,
yeah,
the
yeah.
end of Act 5.
At this point, she's still a little bit snarky,
Yeah. We get Vincentio showing up, Lucentio's father as well.
Exactly, the actual father.
The actual father. Bias. So this web of lies is just about to... like crash down around him.
That's a great scene. I mean, a lot could be said, guys, again, and like if you're writing in your exam, do compare it to the other plays that we mentioned, particularly Twelfth Night. All these plays where gender swapping is being used or identity swapping is being used. Yeah. So it's essentially that's Scene 5. But that's Scene 5, and it all clears up in the end, kind of... I feel like it's a bit of a Deus Ex Machina. Nothing really happens. No one gets punished in the end. I don't find that a strong ending.
In Act 5, Scene 1, we know that Lucentio and Bianca got married secretly. And they show up and say, hey, we got married. And identify themselves. What? Like, how are they not getting in trouble for this?
Well, they get just too strong. You know, both fathers have something strong to say, and that's it. And then we move on to the actual three-part wedding, right? Because we have the two main characters.
You have Biondello and the widower.
And the widow, yeah.
Biondello.
Yes. One of the suitors basically says, well, since I haven't gotten beauty from Bianca, this old widow loves me and has a bit of money, I'll go marry her. And then tries to kind of morally be like, you know, it's not about beauty for me, it's about the kind deeds of this woman. And it's like, well, yeah, after the beautiful one didn't work out, then it's very easy to choose the other one.
Yep. And again, it shows you a constant theme in this play is money and how money manipulates man, in particular man as a male man.
Yeah.
So.
What do we think about how about the ending then? As we get through Act 5, Scene 2, we touch on the ending and we close with a big kind of monologue from Katarina.
It's kind of like an epilogue almost, not necessarily like the ending, but epilogue. But I should also ask, like, PJ, do you want us to even discuss the ending now? I know this is a hang up that you have.
Yeah.
No, we
have to talk about the ending this time because, oh my God, I hate spoilers, but we have to talk about the ending, guys. So,
spoilers.
The ending,
okay.
The Let's ending talk about is it. The most critical part of the whole play. It's about her ultimately. Okay, so the three suitors, the three married men now, they kind of want to see which wife is the most obedient, and they do a little a game, and they say, well, whoever wives come first, we'll call their names, and the wife that abides, that husband will be the winner. And they don't think it's going to be Katarina, but then it is her, and everyone's very surprised. She's the most tamed woman, and then she gives a lecture, essentially, to the other woman and to the woman, to it in the world, that you should be submissive to man, you should be a good housewife. Now it's important to say that sometimes in this stage this is ironically spoken out sarcastically, but sometimes it's also without irony. So I think it's clever.
I'm just going to give you a two line quote here, but thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign. You know, this from the shrew, you know, she has been completely tamed, if you just read this literally without any kind of irony, you know,
but
completely
it also
tamed.
Makes sense for the time period, because this is very, very Christian.
Yeah, well, that's
right.
That's true.
So
nice. final thoughts. I mean, because I thought the ending was going to be that she wins, she fights back, and but no, she just gets tamed. There's no twist, you know, the bad plot just wins, you know. And I guess at the time people thought this was a spectacular way to end. I don't know, maybe they thought this was a very virtuous way to treat your women, but it doesn't, it's difficult for me.
So the ending is very important. So is it her being sarcastic? Is she saying that is she saying this in a manner to please him, but secretly she's trying to also with her sarcasm to say the opposite? Or has she at last been broken down? So it could be seen. I mean, instead, I think it's a very tragic monologue to give, and I don't think that again, it's not Shakespeare's opinion. I don't think so. There are too many strong female characters he writes about, and it's you see, the scene is too vile. It's very disturbing the way they're treating the woman.
Yeah,
and this is the 1590s now. Things are changing. Things are really changing. He's parodying what might have been okay only 10 years before. This is a critical change in society now. So I think if she believes it or not is complex to know right now. But it's definitely supposed to be not okay what she's saying. That's the thing. I definitely think that. What do you guys think?
I want to add just a little bit more depth to this, because we know in Shakespearean time, women did not play the women characters. The female characters were played by men.
Yes.
So I'm wondering how that would appear if a man were the one saying this, dressed as a woman.
Unfortunately, it's their man and the men are talking to men. So it is very disturbing of it, isn't it? So is Shakespeare really such a feminist guy, or it's hard to know.
It gets confusing. You know, for example, even in that induction, you've got a man then acting as a man who is acting as a woman, you know.
Yes, and even I got confused just now when we're talking about it. I remembered also there being a woman there, yeah. So yeah, it is very confusing. It's hard to
know. Now, talking about the ending, I of course it's not great if you see it like done seriously. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that bad compared to like at Petruchio's house, that's where I felt really dirty and really bad. And by the time we got here, it's just like, all right, I'll take it.
Because at Petruchio's house, you kind of feel like she's almost imprisoned. Whereas at least in this final scene, they're out and about again. And that takes away that
basically imagine a dungeon at his house. Like
a
dirty, like Lemony Snicket series of unfortunate events, like Count Olaf's house is what I imagine.
Yes.
Yeah, more or less. Whereas at least in that last scene, they're out at a gathering with the rest of the guys. And I feel less dread. Whereas when they're in the house, I kind of feel scared for her, you know?
Mm.
Definitely, yeah. So I think it is quite disturbing, actually. But yeah, that it is a great, it's greatly written, and it's very dramatic, the ending. Yet, we are supposed to question it now. I think as a modern reader, it's hard to know exactly what was going on in Elizabethan time. I would recommend anyone who's writing on this play to really look and study society at that time.
Yeah, I mean, having a bit of context for the society always helps.
1590s. Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's coming at it from the modern perspective. We haven't really been doing it from the perspective of that time period. And that is going to be something probably very important for if you write about this play. So that's something to keep in mind.
So, yeah. So, again, is it perhaps all the opposite where we're saying, is it a Reader's Excess play? Is it supposed to be we have to control the woman because women at that time were getting more power and starting to question things? So is this Shakespeare perhaps not expressing his ideas, but writing for that particular market of men who want to control women? Is this a play just for men?
To give him his credit, you know, it is a relatively early play, right? You know, we have obviously starting off with the Henrys, you know, and then once we get beyond those, we're looking at the likes of the Comedy of Errors, which I think we agree it is better than this one. But you know, the Comedy of Errors, Taming of the Shrew, maybe they're just still finding his feet with those first couple, you know?
I don't think that's strong enough of an argument, though. That's the thing, because it might have been written early on. It is one of the earlier plays, probably, but it's difficult to know with Shakespeare. And with Shakespeare plays, he wrote so many that it's very difficult for me to understand why did he write Taming of the Shrew and then soon afterwards he would write something like Romeo and Juliet. What you know, how can a man change so radically? I mean, maybe, but I find that it's also very important to remember that he was writing for money. This is a job back then. Shakespeare probably wasn't thinking about, I'm going to win the Nobel Prize or something like that, because it was a Nobel Prize. And he wasn't thinking about art for art's sake. He was thinking about for this is his business, you know.
At the time, it was probably meant to be a satire. Like, probably. That's what I honestly believe. However, doing parts of this as a satire are going to be very difficult. Like the stuff at Petruchio's house, I don't know how you're going to be satirical about that. A better director than me might be able to do it.
It's going to be tough enough, I think. Yeah. But I think this, looking at this as a satire is the only way you can look at it, you know, sans disgust. Thank you.
So let's just talk about the themes that students will have to work on. Cause it's all about money, right? And as you're saying, Alex, class, society, and the gender politics between how it really gives it insights, even if it's a farce, into how women were treated back then. So it's very historically important. Mm-hmm. And how women might have fought back but lost. That's very important to remember. They lost. They definitely lost. They lost. That's an important point of the play. And I think Shakespeare might be secretly, deep down, he might be very sad about it in the end, even though this play is on the surface very much a sexist play.
Mm. When the first time you guys read this, you know, were you also shocked by the ending, or was that just me? Like, did you think that she was going to somehow overcome the odds? You know,
I thought so as a modern reader. No. Yeah. Perhaps back then it was the only ending to give. Shakespeare, you see, it's ultimately important, everyone. Shakespeare might have written an ending that was, oh, well, I'm going to rebel, or like, I'm going to commit suicide, you know. And he eventually did, to be honest, with other plays where women would do this. But Shakespeare would often have to rewrite his plays to please the majority. So also see it from that perspective. See it from art as a means to make money for his bread and for his family, not art for art's sake.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you're right. He saw this as something that he was going to put on, you know, this year. Here's the current play. And then
there was,
put it out of his mind. You know, he didn't think that people were going to be talking about this a couple hundred years later, you know?
You have more freedom making what you want to make after you make a few successful things in the first place. So yeah,
exactly.
Yes. This was done in 1590, 1592, something like that. Exactly. So this might have been just his first one out there. People liked it. Then they said, okay, now you have freedom to do what you want. That's definitely a possibility.
The Taming of a Shrew was already written around that time but they don't know by whom, but it was essentially satirizing Christopher Marlowe's themes and even taking some extract from some lines from that play. It was a popular story at that time. Yet I also feel it could maybe also have been controversial. So was Shakespeare just trying to make himself known by using either a popular story or by taking a controversial story? That could also just be the case. But also, guys, just remember the language in this play. Look at how language is being treated here from a woman's perspective, from a man's perspective, from a woman submitting to a man, from a man controlling a woman. Look at the wordplay. It's very, I think there's a lot to write about that when you're writing your exam. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, look, overall, if we get past the element of disgust, it is a fun and funny play in parts, especially as you mentioned, PJ, with the subplots and the other characters, with Bianca's suitors and things as well. Is there anything else that you want to add, or have we pretty much covered all we were going to cover?
Do you want to go ahead, Alex?
I think that's about everything for me.
There's one more thing, guys. Just one more thing. I think this is very important for the students in exams. Not all of you might be finding it easy to read Shakespeare. So remember, Taming of the Shrew has been adapted many times, and it has been adapted particularly in this first half of the century into many films that were openly sexist. But then when feminists came around, the play was absolutely hated and wasn't adapted much. But in the 90s onward, it's been often redone, particularly the plot about someone wanting to date a younger sister, but the older sister is shrewish, and the father doesn't want the younger woman to date before the older one's dated. And I do suggest to watch these film adaptations, 10 Things I Hate About You, Deliver Us from Eva. Those are just two films that will help you at least understand the story. I do think popular film adaptations taking the loose plot will help you get into the mood of the play.
That's a very good shout. It will, PJ. And even, you know, obviously, you know, you want to focus your essays or whatever on the play, but showing a bit of awareness and cultural awareness of other things that this is maybe actually influenced would do no harm as well. It actually shows more awareness. I wouldn't focus on it more than maybe one sentence, but it does no harm to reference things, you know.
Exactly. You can mention it, guys, but I think also if you're really struggling with the language of the plot, just look into one of those two films, 10 Things I Hate About You, The Lyrics from Eva, just to get into the feeling of the play. All right.
Cool.
No tip.
Well, guys, thanks, Alex and PJ. We have done episode 10. That's been Playboys, and thanks as always to the theme tune provided by Wiggly of Trapdoor, the song Aztec versus Aztown, which is available on most platforms as well. And guys, that's it. Have a Shakespearean day.
Indeed, the same to both of you. It's been a great pleasure.
Had fun.
Oh yeah.
Going together. No shrew, you can't control me. Doesn't matter what I say, don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say. Don't tell me what to do. I ain't your shrew. No, I'm may be your math case, but I'm sure not your math case. I'm a woman's power. I'm not your shrew.
I'm your shrew.
Not your shrew. I'm not your shrew. You can't tame me. Come on, tame me now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.